this is Mary J. Blige.
I'm Nicki Minaj.
What's up? This is Jay-Z.
From London, England and Washington, D.C., you are now tuned in to Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. I'm your host, Allison J., and today we have another exciting guest, Elsa Gillingham. Elsa is an entrepreneur with a passion for leveraging technology to combat domestic violence and to foster women's empowerment. As a survivor of domestic abuse, Elsa is an avid advocate for domestic violence survivors and has delivered in-house training sessions for court mental health departments, seminars, and she is the founder and creator of Shiro Hub. Shiro Hub is a women's empowerment hub which features educational video games and other technology solutions to effect positive social transformation around the prevention of and response to domestic violence. Elsa, thank you for joining us here on Conversations with Allison J, The Journey to Here. Welcome, Elsa.
Thank you for joining me in my new venture that is very scary, but there's no growth in your comfort zone, right?
Absolutely not. I can tell you, spending 18 years in corporate America in banking and then doing something different for the last 2 years, I do occasionally ask myself, would it be better just to have a regular paycheck and the health insurance and, you know, the certainty? But then I'm like, banking was never certain. Yeah, so Devon, my mum is Jamaican, moved to the UK to study nursing, met my father who's white, got married. God knows how she ended up in Somerset to do nursing when everybody else went to the cities. I'm not sure what was going on there. Anyway, I guess she liked it. She still seems to like Devon. It's great. But
I know, right?
Yeah, she loves it there. She doesn't seem to have any issues. It's great. And I love it too. It's beautiful. Mm. But, you know, what everything that's going on right now just reminds me of, coming out of like a dark tunnel with my friend walking to school and another kid says, oh, yeah, well, I could see Justine, but I couldn't see Elsa. skin color jokes and, oh, no, she's going to jump in the pool. The pool's going to turn brown. You know, that kind of thing. Wow. That was my second comprehensive experience, right? But not too bad. I mean, I'd say that was probably 1% of my experience. The rest of it was really largely positive. But yeah, Devon is not diverse at all.
Yeah, I've been there once. That was probably about 10 years ago. Very, very beautiful.
It is. It's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, I love it. I don't want to say, however, too much. I do love it, and I have lots of friends there. It's interesting watching their politics on Facebook and seeing who are really closet racist and that kind of thing. But I'll leave that alone. Mm. But how am I in France? So I ended up going to Cardiff University. My third year was a year in Paris and a year in Spain, and I fell in love with Paris. And then stupidly, I married an American. I don't know what the hell was going on there, but he was a knight in shining armor, a total, like, you know, wonderful guy, really just fantastic. And so I moved to New York and we got married, and I'll tell you about that story in a minute. But to fast forward through that 20-year adventure, in a nutshell, domestic violence were the key words there. And so I managed to kind of somewhat get him out of my life, not completely, still dealing with court cases, unfortunately, even 5 years after kicking him out. But my oldest managed to get into a French university. He wanted to go to NYU, but it didn't work out grade-wise. Honestly, the poor kid just kind of struggled the first 2 years of high school because that was the beginning of the divorce, and there was just so much emotionally going on that I just think he couldn't. But he did spectacularly the last 2 years of high school, and so I managed. We found some options here in Europe that's 1 year less than America, of course, and a whole lot cheaper. And so I said, oh, let's go to France for a year. I'll come. So he's got 1 year in Paris. Next September, he's supposed to be in Turin, and then the final year in Berlin on a management bachelor's. So, you know, against the wishes of the other two, I just picked him up, and with the dog, here we are in Paris.
So, even though it was against their wishes, how are they finding it now? They're good.
They got the point. I said, you know what, Mummy really needs some time away from America. I was actually having nightmares, where, you know, we were still in the family house. Of course, my ex knows where it is, and so I was having nightmares. He was coming in and shooting the kids dead, and then I was, you know, hearing the gunshots. And so it was just nice to get away, honestly. Really, really nice to get away.
I can imagine. And your mental state, the sanity.
It's kind of funny because, normally I'm functioning just great, but it was just one episode where my brother-in-law came into the house and there were all these funny banging noises and footsteps, and I woke up hearing that and it freaked me out more than I realized. So there's obviously some PTSD there that I had forgotten. But so to explain to you that story, that side of things, the whole, I'm going to read you a little story. It's called The Room. Birds chirping, leaves rustling, the heat rose, but the breeze was so delicious. With eyes closed, the room was a tranquil delight, a place to savor with a blissfully comfortable couch and the sense of being out in nature. With your eyes open, the sunroom was a less inviting prospect. The perfect place for a summer afternoon nap was cluttered with toys, with a dusty log pile left over from a mild winter. There was barely room to navigate past stacks of stored beach chairs and a messy table to be able to reach the oasis, the sofa. The sofa, an old dilapidated three-seater from the 70s covered with hideous tartan, was a much-loved friend and comfort. Opening one's eyes whilst reclined on the sofa, if you're at the correct angle, gave a view of the peaceful green walls and the verdant yard outside, the grapevine taking command of the rhubarb patch and engulfing the poorly tended tomato plants. Indeed, the sunroom was a bit of paradise in the wild, inside and out, ripe for the best of the best summer afternoon naps, or the sagging, slightly dusty sofa. Was the sunroom perhaps the only sanctuary in a house of war? Elsewhere, memories, flashbacks rich with fear and confusion were in the walls, the furniture, and the air of every other room, even the laundry room. The house would be a home, she had thought, on the day it became theirs, a place to be filled with joy, the laughter of children, happy moments and peace. Instead, in one corner of the bedroom was the memory of feet dangling, being raised high and choked for daring to ask for the volume of the TV to be turned down. A dressing room where an iPhone was smashed when she tried to call 911 as his hands were wrapped around her neck. The sofa, behind which he purposefully hid the double stroller so she would struggle through the airport on a business trip with two young boys. It was old now, and the leather was scuffed. The shower door that he shattered when he broke down the bathroom door to put her in a chokehold, fixed, but never would close properly afterwards, so that every time she bathed the daughter, she had a reminder of that day. So many memories in so many rooms. But fear and confusion can be chased away with knowledge, and she felt herself very blessed and fortunate to have stumbled across some books. Covert aggression, the author called it. Covert aggression. Everything was intentional. Night after night, quietly reading under the covers once the monster had fallen asleep, she awoke to the truth. The good times were not real. The bad times were the reality, and the good times were the method of gathering ammunition in preparation for the next explosion. One day, an innocuous lie woke her up fully. He was literally trying to change her memories and perception of reality. The fog of cognitive dissonance suddenly cleared. The children didn't know that in their innocent remarks, they'd proven him a liar. Worse, he spent 2 days trying to convince her how awful she was, resorting to stonewalling, aggression, threats to her life when her reaction didn't suit, and then a smear campaign with her friends in church. She woke up, and once awake, it was as if she'd never been in that fog for 17 years. She was back. The kitchen, with the fridge that still evidenced his punch mark, became the room of revelation. The family computer had been syncing up with his phone. iMessage told all. So many messages evidencing his lies, his intentions to kill her, his intentions to destroy her spiritually and mentally. They were all there. The stonewalling and intermittent threats continued. Daily she went to work and daily she returned home, fearful, heart racing with a can of pepper spray in one hand and a panic alarm in the other, rushing to the bedroom to lock the door and push a heavy armoire against it. The house was cleansed one day with the help of a domestic violence support agency and the local police. The path to freedom was strewn with perils, landmines even, the tower slashing, the day he accused her of adultery, threatening to kill her, and she fled to the Connecticut Hotel with the children. The mind manipulation of the children, brutal, blatant in the goal of turning them against her, she plodded through it all. Then one day she awoke in the sunroom, her sanctuary, the one room innocent of any sad memories. The birds were chirping, the wind was rustling through the leaves, the sun was dancing on the ceiling. The room was a mess, but her children were calm. She was at peace, and he was gone, banished rather to a monitored messaging service with four orders of protection to keep the distance. The passage of time sped opened the windows of the house to fresh air, fresh laughter, and it washed the walls of their ugly memories, painting new ones instead. The joy of children able to run in and out freely with friends, cuddles and affection allowed, no longer constrained. Little by little, their souls healed and her heart forgave the predator for being a predator, forgave from a distance, and worked patiently for her freedom. The end. Or not the end, actually, because there was like 5 years of court stuff after that and more mind manipulation of the children. But anyway.
I am stunned, speechless. I have seen domestic abuse, unfortunately. Mm. I have a family member that I witnessed abusing his wife. And,
And
I'm not saying this to blow my own trumpet, but now that I think about it, it was one of those things where I didn't know what to do. So what I did know what to do, I exposed it. I told everybody in the family. I called
bring out to the light.
Yeah, I was like, because I thought to myself, I'm like, because I've never seen anything like it, like that before. I mean, I have some, and before that, I had been abused as a child, but my own experiences of a domestic abuse hadn't started yet.
So
I did not know what in the world that was, and I remember, because we were in London, and I remember calling family members from Birmingham and everywhere saying, no, you've got to come and talk to him, you've got to come and deal with this, you've got to come and do this. And seeing it, and I didn't see it to the extent, obviously, that you have just spoken of. I just saw the physical parts of it. And I remember hearing some of the accusations of adultery and cheating and so on. Mm-hmm. And tried as I might to help. Like, I was with her all day. There's no way she was with somebody. I was there. And his was like, he didn't want to hear what I had to say, because in his
head, gaslighting.
It was what it was. And I remember when I stopped trying to help him, was he made a statement that to this day, he says, when I'm right, I'm right. And even when I'm wrong, I'm right.
Oh, yeah. Wrong and strong. Yeah.
That was the statement that was made. And it was from that day on, I thought to myself, you know something? You are not somebody that I'm even going to waste the energy trying to help. I will just keep the energy I was putting in to try and help you, I'll add that to the energy I was using to help her.
To help her, yeah. And she needed that, trust me. Yeah. That was a good decision. That was a very good move.
Stunned, like, at first I thought I heard wrong.
Yeah. No, because they say outrageous stuff. Sociopaths will say really outrageous stuff. And you're like, nah, they couldn't have meant that. But that is the clue. So I presented to the New York City Family Court Mental Health Department back in 2017 on psychological abuse. And I used my own case as an example. And they pulled me aside. They took me to lunch afterwards. And they said, well, how are we supposed to spot these people? Because, I mean, these abusers, you know, couples come in and the wife is like all ruffled and a total mess. And, the guys sat there all calm. Or, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that it's always the woman who's abused and always the man that's the abuser. But in that context, it certainly seemed like that was the majority of cases. And typically it is. But so they're like, how are we supposed to know? We get to meet them two, maybe three times before we have to make a custody determination. I said, you have to listen for the things that they say that you think they were joking on, and then really reflect on that they weren't joking.
Mm.
My ex would say outrageous things all the time, and people go, oh, Alan's so funny, Alan's got such a sense of humor. I'm like, no, he's actually doing that He's actually doing that in the background, people.
And that's the thing that I was actually going to ask you. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you, and I know there's going to be people that's listening, because especially, you know what it's like when somebody has not experienced a situation or anything like that, they find it hard to comprehend. And the question is, how did you not see it? How did you get to the point where you were married to the man and you didn't know he was this person? That's one of the things I would like you to please explore, if you don't mind, that journey, that part of your journey that led from you met this guy, fell in love with this guy, and this guy ended up almost killing you and driving you insane. How does that journey take place? And I know, like, in my own story, how that happened, because charming, charismatic businessman, but I want to hear, and again, my experience is nowhere near to the point of yours, because I am thankful he didn't put his hands on me in that sense to try to take my life. And that's the thing that, you know, I think sometimes we need to really delve into and just be real with that part of the journey, and please be as gritty and as open as you need to be, so that people can really see, look, you're not going to instantly see this person, and they're not going to nobody walks around revealing that to you. It's a bit like a woman that's pregnant. It's only those people that after a period of time, when she's heavily showing and stuff like that, that you start to see. So it's a period of time, a gestation period, so to speak. So please tell me about your journey from meeting this man to him almost killing you.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in the story that I read you, it my story, which I wrote in the third person, it really tells you about that love bombing phase, right? So abusive people will very often be absolutely charming in the beginning. And I mean, I have no idea what percentage of abusers are sociopaths, but if you look at the personality traits of somebody who's on the sociopathic spectrum, let's call it, right, the ASBD spectrum, you are looking at people who are glib, who can be very charming. That's just a part of that personality trait. And so for me, the mistake was being taken in by somebody who was very charming, a knight in shining armor, very attentive. You know, the key words were soulmates. I've never felt like this before, you know, and before you know it, you're starting to believe all of that, whether you come into it feeling the same way or not. There's just a certain set of key phrases that are real warning flags for me now at this point. And I think, you know, taking the time to get to know somebody is critical. It really is very important, because if you don't give yourself the chance to see those warning flags, those warning signs, then you're tied in financially, or, you know, via marriage or with children, before it's, and then getting out of that is very, very difficult. And I'll tell you, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the abuse probably started when I was the physical abuse started when I was pregnant with my first child. So let's say that was 18 and a bit years ago, right? So maybe a year and a half after we got married, possibly 2 years. And, you know, I knew things weren't right, but honestly, I would say to my friends, you know, sometimes it's better to keep your friends close and your enemies closer, so you know what they're doing. And the risks for somebody who's got children with an abuser exiting is very, very dangerous. You're exiting a relationship with somebody that you know does not wish you well. The chances of mortality are very high. And in my case, I certainly felt like my life was at risk many times in the exit. And then on top of that, quite often, and what was quite a shock to me was getting the order of protection, which protected me from having to see him, but then being asked in this, you know, literally the same breath from that lawyer who helped me get the order of protection was, right, he wants to see the children. When can you drop the children off?
Oh, okay.
So, yes, I know. So, hold on a second. I just told you that he's beating me. Let's look at the statistics. right. So the impact to children, whether they are being abused or not, in that household, you know, you're sending them off with somebody who is abusive. Mm. So that's just that's really not very wise, because if you look at the statistics, I think there are 800 plus children that have been killed by vindictive spouses to spite the victim in right. the last 10 years in the States. Yeah. So, you know, there are fortunately some laws that have come out recently. There was a concurrent resolution that a number of people, me included, felt very strongly about. And so we pushed for this, which is it pushes the states, each individual state, to very strongly consider the safety of the child in custody cases where domestic violence has been alleged, which tells you that, you know, that wasn't being considered before
as much as it should have been. Because that's one of the things that I actually wanted to ask you about, the effect it had on your children. Because mm-hmm. when we hear domestic abuse, domestic violence, we automatically think of adults. We just right. think of from one adult to another, be it man to woman, woman to man. We just think of adults. We don't stop mm-hmm. to think of in that whole domestic abuse situation, children. And it's like we compartmentalize it, because then we call childhood abuse when children are being physically and mentally abused, and then so it's like we've separated the two and don't realize really that one could be as a result of the other and things like that. And so that's one of the things. So was he abusive towards your children?
He was physically abusive to the children, and that was something that was honestly not obvious mm-hmm. all of the time. It was it was obviously mentally abusive, now that I reflect on it, but he always played it as being a strict, he was a very authoritarian style, mm-hmm. I think is the correct way to call it. But yes, it came out in counseling afterwards with the children that yes, there was a lot of stuff going on. Exactly. And so I think that when you are talking about domestic violence with the adult, I think that there is a high proportion of children in that household that if they're not already very much experiencing the feelings and the sentiment and all of the currents that are going on in the household, as if that wasn't enough, they probably are also experiencing some form of abuse.
Wow.
So... yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we have all heard of childhood abuse and children being killed, but I don't mm-hmm. think it is really spoken about, because and the sad thing is in some cases you have both the parents abusing the child. So when we talk about child abuse, or when we hear child abuse, that's actually one of the first things that comes to mind, as opposed to if we're looking at a child that's being abused by a parent, is that right. parent doing anything to the other parent?
Right.
Is this an entire situation that needs to be unraveled, and it's from that spouse is just abusing everybody in that house?
Basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's, you know, from my perspective, you know, I was at work and he was at home with the children. And so it was even worse, because I was in the position where I was being told by lawyers, if you leave him, then the chances are that the court's going to give the children to him. So how do you then, you know, risk leaving a situation where now you found out that, you know, he's really dangerous to you and you believe he's dangerous to your children. But yet if you leave, the court's probably not going to believe you and probably will leave the children with him, giving him probably more licensed to be even more dangerous. Now, what happened actually was that I got an order of protection and he was kicked out by the cops. And he turned super nice with the children as a way to turn them against me. So actually the children probably were somewhat, it felt like they were safer. Now I always had that underlying fear that something might happen that would cause him to become one of those vindictive parents that killed the children, and that was always a fear for me. But you know, there was a period of the children just, you know, getting new sneakers and new bikes, and, you know, it was a golden phase. But, you know, it was very obvious what was going on, and never more so than when I started getting text messages from mutual friends asking me why on earth my daughter's eczema was being allowed to get so bad. And it turned out that he was using a new strategy. I'm not even sure I've seen it documented. So he and I both knew that my daughter was very sensitive to gluten. And so he was actually feeding them excessive amounts of pizza and donuts. He was even sending them home from their visits with bagfuls of donuts, which, of course, I couldn't take away and throw away without daddy at the point, right? And so my daughter's eating all of this gluten, and her arms just flared up. The worst gluten ever. And I thought it was bad, but I said, you know, I mean, there couldn't be anything to this. And then I started getting text messages from these mutual friends saying, what kind of mother am I that I'd let my daughter's eczema get so bad? You know, it's so that the tactics switched drastically after separation to become more of a psychological manipulation.
Gaslighting, right? It's a form of gaslighting.
Well, yeah, gaslighting, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, these are just dangerous strategies. Imagine if she, you know, really had very bad eczema.
Yeah, or so, that some kind of other, like a nut allergy or something that could have actually really endangered her life.
Absolutely. Nice. So, yeah, so going back to your question about how do you end up with such a person? Well, you know, how do you discover who is a wolf in sheep's clothing? Mm-hmm. How do you identify that? And I think, you know, in some ways, you have to look at people's output. It's not what people say. And I used to often feel overwhelmed. I'm not a person of many, many words, although it might seem like I am right now. But, you know, living with him, he was always the one who did all the talking all the time, a lot of chatter, and it was really confusing to me. It kind of fogged my mind with all of these words, and I realized that, you know, actually this is a real key characteristic here, because the words were not matching up with the deeds. There were so many words that it was difficult to weed out where I should be watching for which deeds were happening. But the volume of words really obscured the lack of fruit and output.
Wow.
I have to say.
So, and how did you function through this? Because, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, many times when you see a woman with a lot of makeup on, it's like, oh, I walked into the door, right? I mean, did you have to hide what you were going through, or were you open with it and about it?
Yeah, so I never had any, I think once I might have had a physical bruise on my arm where he twisted my arm, and, you know, and so I wore long sleeves to work that day. But, you know, and for a couple of days after that, but really it was a psychological impact to me. It was the stress of, you know, he's angry with me as I'm on my way out to work, or invariably, if I went on business trips, I took the children with me. So if I was flying to the UK for a business trip, I was coming along with my 2 and 4 year olds, and I negotiated that up front with my company because I was way too nervous to leave them for an extended period with him, and that was a function of the job that I had to go. But there was always some kind of ruckus that occurred before the trip that meant that I was traveling very, very stressed. And so I would say that there was a constant environment of stress and adrenaline that I was operating out of. Not to mention that I had a corporate job that was very, you know, it was already pretty demanding, but it was a constant adrenaline rush and constant uncertainty. You know, it really, if you look at the cycle of abuse, it was the honeymoon to, you know, the incremental rising of tension to the explosion. And it was a constant circular. And what was difficult to spot about it was that the physical violence, which everybody recognizes as domestic violence, was really, really sporadically occurring, right? I mean, I could tell you there were probably 5 years in between two episodes. That's enough for you to think that, you know, everything's fine. That was just an anomaly, right? And, you know, after one episode, he even put himself through a course on anger management.
But do you think that was a genuine thing, or just was that something that he used to make you think that he was trying?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that certificate on anger management was displayed for years on the mantelpiece as a trophy of how he had worked on himself to improve himself. But you know what? Somebody who does domestic violence, who's an abuser, it's not an anger management problem. That's a rage. That is rage. And they manage that perfectly fine, because my experience would be there was absolute rage-filled moments in the house. And then we get to church, and I come running down the stairs at church to the children's ministry and bump into him happily chatting away with somebody. And, you know, then he talked to me, which is another form of gaslighting, because then I'm completely confused. Wait a minute. You're at home and you were livid with me, so livid that we couldn't even drive together. But then in front of this person at church, we're buddies. So that's not rage. That's not anger management. That's a rage that is used to control somebody.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned church, because that's where I was actually going next. So,
yes.
So how, because there's, you know, we're surrounding the church, there's just so many questions, right? And it's just like, because I'm being somebody that grew up in church, so I get it-ish. But was there anybody that you could go to at church that you felt you could go to that would believe you? Because remember, there's this charming, charismatic, he's so great, stays home with the children person, and you're the career woman that goes out to work. Was there anybody that you could have gone to that you would have felt like, okay, this person, they'll believe me, I can go to them?
Well, let me tell you, I am so blessed that I actually kept a spreadsheet of the blessings that occurred to me from probably when I kicked him out early 2015 until at least the end of 2016. And I have multiple blessings that I recorded in a month. One of them was my next door neighbors. So just before all of this craziness kicked off, where I had my light bulb moment and realized that I was in danger and his behavior was escalating and the threats were getting worse, some wonderful people from church moved in next door. And the wife spotted what I was dealing with a mile off. And first off, couples were friends, and they'd come round and the kids would hang out together, which was great. But I noticed she was asking very probing questions, which really exposed his patriarchal stance and really kind of shed light on his authoritarian, really, very dictatorial style of parenting. And when things really got crazy, boy, oh boy, was I so lucky. They were right there next door, praying for me, helping me when my kids were behaving in a crazy fashion. They were right there. Their kids were helping me. You know, I got heads up on things like the fact that he was going to take me to court to stop me from putting the kids in school, because my kids told her kids and her kids told her. And so she told me, she said, get prepared. He's going to take you to court and stop you from putting the kids in school because he wants you to pay him to homeschool them. That kind of thing. So,
oh, interesting. Like, wow.
Yeah, I know. You couldn't make it up, really. Mm-hmm. Some of the court cases. If I can't wait to finish writing my book and put all the stuff in there, because it's just,
I can't wait for you to finish writing your book.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous. The things that happened. But you know, when I talk about the church, you know, these people were friends from church. They didn't represent the church, but thank God they were there, and they were fantastic. The church, it was a little difficult with the church. He was key and integral, or he seemed to be, to a lot of things there. He was a part of the men's ministry. He occasionally would present and seemed to be very tight with some of the ministers. And basically, you know, from the same search on iMessage, I was on the family computer, I was finding messages from him to the pastor about how disrespectful I was, how challenging it was to be married to me. You know, he just couldn't hold on anymore with this. And so he had been priming actually the ministers of the church for a while about what an awful woman I was. So, you know, when everything went down and I got an order of protection, I actually was getting bombed in the church lobby about why I was such an unforgiving wife, why I wasn't willing to take him back. I went for a counseling session with him and told the pastor in tears that, you know, he was strangling me, or he had strangled me. Mm-hmm. And kind of the response was, well, let's sing Kumbaya and pray about that. That sounds terrible. Okay. As if, you know, get over it, dear. We know you're lying and you've got some psychological problems. Mm. But I mean, honestly, now I'm very glad that I stuck with it, because the church is fantastic, and he showed his true colors, and we were able to organize a big domestic violence training session with the church, and train all the pastors and the lay people. After you know, after a season, I waited, I bided my time, and then I pulled out a PowerPoint and actually read them the same story I read you, and that seemed to clarify some stuff. And So that kind of inspired me to create a video game or a training session that helps pastors to empathize with what a domestic violence victim may be going through. And so I networked with
empathize, because I did have a look at it, and it was it was I started, and because I'm not a video games person, the extent of my video games is Tetris. So that just goes to show you, because I know nothing about video games, but. I was on it, and I wanted to keep going and keep exploring the scenarios, and I just wanted to keep looking. So when you went to them and you showed them like the PowerPoint and you read it to them, did any of them actually ever come back to you, especially when you said, because he showed his true colors, did any of those same people that were like, oh, be a good girl, get over it, and just, you know, be a good wife, Did any of those people actually come back to you to say, wow, sorry, we didn't believe you. You've got this game here that shows us how to be more empathetic. But did anybody come to you and say, but show us and tell us, what do we look for?
Yeah, so absolutely. So they were amazing, and they really understood once we talked about it a bit more. They've been incredibly supportive, and I'm very blessed to be a part of that church, even though I'm not physically in the States right now, but I follow everything that's going on with them now. But I think there was a genuine interest to support my idea. Now, they haven't actually seen what I've created. You've seen it, and they haven't seen it yet, because I'm still working on it. Thank you. I know that there are some things that still need to be done to it. I want to build out some other scenarios. I mean, loosely, the scenarios are built on the different segments of the power and control wheel. So evidencing the different types of abuse that can happen. And so there are a couple more scenarios I need to address. And then actually the concept of including human trafficking in was from another pastor from a completely separate church, who said, wow, this is a great idea. I think you could add in human trafficking here, because if you've got children's ministry and the children are showing signs of human trafficking, that's the first line of defense, isn't it? I mean, they're around the youth pastors and other pastors. They should be able to, should be equipped to be able to identify the signs of that. So I'm very excited about it. I've got a number of pastors who are interested in what I'm doing. So it's just a case of finishing it up and putting it out there.
Well, that's excellent. And honestly, I pray that you have so much success with it, because it's just, you know, it's one of the things why I believe that I have been given this platform and I want to use it, is because there's lots of conversations that could save lives, lots of conversations that really need to be had that we're not having.
Yes, and so you have to bring it to the light.
And I'm not afraid to have conversations that other people won't have, like domestic abuse. whether it be a man being abused or a woman being abused, because that's one thing that's not even spoken about. Everybody just assumes the woman being abused. But what about those men that are there suffering in silence because they're shamed and there's stigma about it? Yeah. And human trafficking, sex trafficking. I saw a couple of movies. One of them had, what's the actress's name? Paula Patton in it, called Traffic. But there was another one that I saw before that it made me so scared, because I was completely ignorant to how these things can happen and how these things can be. And I think because there are things that are not being spoken about, because we want to live in this rose-tinted world, and the reality is the world is not rose-tinted. And if we don't have these conversations, people's lives could be in danger, because people are naive to some of the real perils and dangers that do exist in this world. And I'm not trying to scaremonger anybody. No. It's not even about scaremongering or people living with the fear of God in them, and they have to be like, you know, have every door bolted, every window bolted because they're scared. It's just a case of, no, just be aware. Like, for example, I was saying to my mum the other day, and I'm like, Mum, you need to be more aware of yourself. I was really telling her off. You'd think I was the parent, right? Like, you need to be more aware of your surroundings. Because I'm like, Mum, when you get in your car, you shut the door, you lock the door, and if you need to fix what's in your bag or whatever, you do that in the car with the door shut.
Afterwards.
Because there was one, because my mum's been living here for many, many years.
Right.
And there was an incident I saw with my mum. I was livid. We were in an area that's not too great, and it was late, and we were just coming from somewhere, thought, you know, let's stop and get something to eat. So she went in to get, because I was driving in my car behind her, so she got there before me. She went in, came back out, got in her car, was fixing everything in her bag with the car door wide open. Remember, now this was gone 10 o'clock at night in an area that wasn't too great. And I'm looking at this lady like, Mom. And I ran down my window. I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? Get in the car and shut the door. And I say, Mom, and that's how, you know, some people, because they don't have that awareness about them, that's how they get, you know, for example, I'm not saying everything's going to lead to sex and human trafficking, but that's how somebody can get mugged off their handbag.
Absolutely, get carjacked and
And that's one of the things. So it's not that I want everybody to live in fear, but just have an awareness about you, about your surroundings, and what is actually happening in this world. Because unfortunately, it's, you know, like you said, we're not all holding hands and singing Kumbaya. There's some very real.
Not everybody wishes you well. Yeah, not everybody wishes you well. And for me, it was very well illustrated when I was going through the early phases of exiting from my situation. And my father, who was 70 at the time, said, in my 70 years, I have never encountered somebody like this. Who he actually was gaslighting my father, and that was one of the final straws for me. And he said, you know, I didn't even know people existed like this, who don't wish you well, you know, who want harm for you, psychological or physical. And, you know, if you can get to 70 and not encounter that, I think that's the blessed life. But I mean, it's not that I want to, you know, yell and shout about my experience, and to a certain extent there is some risk involved to that, right? But for me, to cast light, to shed light on something in a way that people can understand, so that it helps others to empathize with people in their lives who might be going through it, or it helps somebody to wake up to what they're going through themselves and say, hold on a second, I thought I was going crazy. You're telling me that, you know, all those times where I thought I was going crazy, no, I really should be listening to that little voice in my head. My instinct isn't off. You know, for those people who are going through something, hearing somebody else sharing about it can be just the thing that gets them thinking about how they can get out safely.
And it will be freeing for them,
It will be freeing for them. The thing that I would say is that anybody who thinks they're in that kind of situation really needs to think very carefully about how they exit for the same, yeah. you know, for the danger that they could be in, mm-hmm. depending on the type of person they're dealing with. But yeah, I think it's very important to be able to put things in the light, right? Mm-hmm. To expose those wolves in sheep's clothing, because they cause damage not just to the victim or to the victim, to their children, but it's to the entire community when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
You think about me going to work all those years, and I don't know how long I, you know, how many days, well, not days, but how many minutes of the day I might spend, you know, searching in my handbag for something, pretending I'm not crying, or how long I was spending in bathrooms, you know, at work, upset and, you know, not able to go sit at my desk. And you think about the economic impact, you think about the physical impact, the psychological impact. And I mean, if you take it that one step further, right, children can learn from that behavior and take yeah. it into the next generation.
Yeah.
And even, I mean, if you look at, there are some studies on epigenetics that tell us that the stress from it can even be passed down through genetics to the next generations, right? So this is not just about that one victim or potentially that victim and children. It's a whole community and generational impact.
It's a ripple effect, isn't it?
Very much.
Yeah, and yeah, that's absolutely. One thing that I don't think we ever stop to think about. We think it's just contained in that one household, not realizing, like you said, and you touched on him priming the ministers by the tone and the communication, and even gaslighting yeah. your father, and even making you yeah. to the point where, imagine, the people that raised you could be questioning yeah. you,
right,
because yes. of how they psychologically have been infiltrating and getting into their
head. That's right. Absolutely. But I mean, the way that it is done is very, very primal, but clever. Mm-hmm. So if you tell somebody just a drop of truth, if you speak to what they want to hear, then you can add a whole load of lies around it, was wow. what I found. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, speaking to my father and saying, well, you know how headstrong she is and stubborn. Okay, that's true. I am headstrong and I'm stubborn. And then adding into that, once you've got the agreement, adding into that, well, yeah, she's just disrespectful and I can't handle living with her and it's very, very difficult. And, you know, so weaving that story around some truth validates. And so you yeah. have to be very careful to watch for people who will I don't even want to call it stretching the truth. I would say sprinkling truth in with a whole, you know, lot of lies
yeah.
that, you know, achieves a manipulation of somebody around you. The smear campaign is the term for, you know, basically manipulating people around the victim.
My goodness.
So, yeah, so it's really...
5 years now of court battles.
Pretty much, yeah. So I've become my own lawyer at this point. I was very, very blessed. That was one of my miracles. I had a fantastic lawyer from a domestic violence support agency to get me my first order of protection. And then she passed me along to another wonderful lady who's become a very dear friend. But it just got very, very expensive, like 2.5 years into it. You know, we're talking about... you know, a couple of years of American university costs were spent on
legal
on legal wow. fees. And so I said, you know what, I'm enjoying reading all of these orders and motions that she's writing, and I can use them and try and write my own. And so I did. And so yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of court cases. I think at one point I probably had maybe 5 different concurrent court cases between 2 different courts going on. Custody, the divorce, child support, other things. There was, I think, oh no, 3 different courts actually, because there was a criminal court, there was a Supreme Court, and there's a family court. Right. So yeah, so it's heartwarming. I can walk into my local family court and they say, hi, Mrs. Gilliam, how are yeah. you? I've got you checked off already. Everybody knows me. And they know me fairly well at the Supreme Court too.
And but, what have you, after all this time, what are these court cases, what effect are they having on your children? Or I mean, where do they stand? What are they thinking? What do they think about their father even?
Well, the children are really free. About a year and a half into the divorce and separation, he gave my daughter, who was 7 at the time, a big knife.
A big knife.
It was, I'm saying knife, but it kind of looked like a machete to me. Wow. To play with, yes. The story goes that they went to medieval times in New Jersey, and on the way out through the gift shop, she said, "Oh, Daddy, I'd really like one of those swords." And he said, "Ha, ha, ha, why would I get you a plastic one? I can get you a real one for the same $20. And the children kind of looked at each other nervously and, you know, went back to his place. And the next weekend, lo and behold, there's a big knife waiting for my daughter to play with. And I got a rather anguished text message from my younger son saying, "Mummy, Daddy's given Ava a knife to play with." And I said, "Well, I mean, it's plastic, right?" "No, it's cold, hard metal," came back the text message response. And so there I had to take some steps to sort that one out, because the children were just not comfortable. Well, Ava was perfectly happy to go back and she was fine with that, but the others were not at all comfortable.
She was too young to really know.
She was 7.
Yeah.
7. So, it really was a defining moment for him, because then he came up in front of the judge and repeatedly called it a gift until finally the judge said, "I'm sorry, but that's not a gift that's appropriate for a 7-year-old.
It's not a gift appropriate for anybody other than somebody going to cut down sugarcane in the field.
Thank you. Yes. And so ultimately, I think in that particular court case, which took a year, by the way, right? It took a year from filing till I finally got a permanent order of protection for the kids. But in that year, true colors were shown to the judge, which was helpful to me. I mean, I really didn't need to say anything. The photos pretty much said everything for me. But it was very interesting because I felt the need to justify myself and to defend myself. So in that court case, there are many, many times parental alienation was thrown up at me. That's a buzzword that's been discredited. And it's often a buzzword that's thrown at the victim, the domestic violence victim, telling them that they are alienating the kids because the kids don't want to go with the abuser, right? The kids are scared to go with the abuser. The kids don't. So that was my first real example of that. And goodness me, he threw that up many times. It was very tempting to answer, "Well, no, they don't want to go because you're crazy," or, you know, because they know exactly who you are. But,
or they're
you know,
scared. Just, you know, bottom line, not, you know, putting him being crazy aside, they're scared. They're children. Yeah. You're their father, you're their parent, you're supposed to be protecting them, and they're seeing that you've given the youngest like a machete to play with.
Yeah, and not supervising it, you know, leaving the room, leaving her with the others. So it was, unfortunate, but it gave the children their freedom, because that from that point on, they were assigned a lawyer each, and they were assigned a counsellor, and they told the counsellor, "We have nothing to learn from this person. We don't want to go to visitation. We do not feel safe." And, you know, even when this was said in court, he would then come up with, "Oh, she's just telling them to say that." But those were conversations between them and the counselor, nothing that I was involved in. And so fortunately, all three of the children's lawyers, my lawyer knew that, the counselor knew that. So, you know, there was never any need to actually defend myself against that. But I can imagine for others going through that situation, and I know others going through that situation who have been painted badly by the abuser to the point where they've lost their kids to the abuser. So it's a very, very scary business.
Yeah.
But my kids are free and they are very happy. And that freedom is really what gave me the autonomy to say, you know what? I am tired of going to restaurants in New York and having to seat myself so I can see the door in case he comes in. Mm. I am going on a university trip and we're all going to go along and have an adventure in France. So
that's, get some breathing space.
Breathing space, yeah. And it wasn't even so obvious to me until I went back to the States in September to file some papers. So, you know, yet again, another court case that I was filing for. But he, for me, going back in September, it became very vivid and obvious to me how tense I was while I was there. My before going to France.
Yeah.
You know, I'm back in that environment where I'm driving around, not sure if I'm going to bump into him. I'm walking into court, not sure, you know, going to restaurants and, I love that.
Yeah, just how
Jamaican food is my comfort food. And exactly, yeah. I mean, my favorite restaurants, you know, my comfort food Jamaican restaurants, I could bump into him in those easily, right? Mm-hmm. So it has been a breath of fresh air to be out of that environment. And it wouldn't have happened if the children had not gained that order of protection. So that was another one of my miracles, honestly. But I mean, it doesn't end there. It just, you know, the attempts of damage to the children just continued in other ways, honestly. So we were taking care of my mother-in-law at one point, his mother, who became very ill and became bedridden in a nursing home. And he had not spoken to her in 7 years, actually. And then suddenly I think he figured out that was a great way to hurt the children and me. Was to take control. So he actually went in there, reconciled with her. Of course, she was overjoyed that her son was back and, you know, her life, had her sign power of attorney, and then moved her from that nursing home and refused to tell anybody where she was. Yeah. And sent the most hurtful text messages to, you know, my middle son, who asked where she was, saying, "She doesn't want to see you." Well, I'm sorry, but there's no way. That doesn't make sense. So, you know, other attempts to hurt the children continued.
You know, the thing that, you know, thinking about it, you're saying, you know, other attempts to hurt the children. But I tell you what really came to me. The good thing is, because your children have you and a person that has your strength and your vision, because of the neighbors that you had, yes, what he's doing is hurting them by stopping them, but that he's actually, the most damage he's doing, which I don't think, you know, obviously people like that don't realize, the only person really he's doing damage to is himself, because as you've said, he's shown his true colors to so many people. This man has no credit. It sounds like he's got no credibility left unless he starts meeting new people.
Yeah. And they get, that's right, in.
But, and you just look,
well, and he runs through them pretty quickly too. Yeah, he really does run through his friends fairly quickly. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, I actually took him to court to get the children visitation rights to their grandmother, and it could have been a landmark case if the judge had actually decided on it, but she decided that she didn't want to opine on it. So basically, often what happens is that grandparents seek visitation rights with the grandchildren. Mm. And because she was incapacitated, I sought to reverse that and to get the grandchildren access rights to the incapacitated grandmother. But ultimately, the court did not opine. But this is what the judge said. The court finds this case to be very sad. Putting the grandmother's feelings aside, these children who have already been through extensive and contentious litigation will grow up and they'll process what has happened, and everyone will have to live with the results. And, you know, I have to think that I don't think the judge was addressing me in that, right? I mean,
they have to appear to be impartial, right?
Right, exactly. But to keep a grandmother who was there from day one with her grandchildren away,
especially, you know, considering he didn't speak to her for so many years.
For 7 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, we've been visiting her. I mean, I was visiting her on a daily basis from the beginning. I was the one who took her to the hospital, in fact, because her neighbors called me, because I was the only point of contact that they knew of, right? So that's how close we were with my mother-in-law. And my children came with me, you know, at least once a week, if not multiple times a week, to take care of her and to spend time with her and sing her songs and all that goofy stuff. And it's unfortunate, but you know what you say is absolutely correct. that there are statistics that say if a child who has gone through that kind of situation has just one light in their life, one strong person to guide them away from that way of life, they'll be fine. Becoming an abuser can be learnt, or yeah. You know, it can also be a question of nature. You know, you're born like that with that kind of brain structure where you are prone to being abusive. But I think if you are very careful to support people who are going through that situation, the victims are given enough strength from the community, then the children in that situation will be fine. What's risky is when the victim is not believed, the children are then thrown to the abuser as if the abuser is the knight in shining armor and the savior, right? Because there you're actively permitting children to model and become the next generation of abusers.
And that's because that is what they will know. That is what they see. Exactly. Because I'm a firm believer that in so many cases, people become a product of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is all you've seen, if that is all you know, then mm-hmm. what are the chances of you being any other way? And if it's a father being an abusive husband, that's what you're teaching your sons to do and be. And then you're teaching your daughter to be a victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe that it, and I've done some research on this, it happens in two ways. One, they're social learning. They're learning from what they're socialized and what they see. But then also the stress of that situation can compromise the prefrontal lobe and the amygdala, such that your facility for empathy and for emotions is stunted. And so there you are also creating an abuser. Right. If you're a child growing up in a hugely stressful situation, your brain is not given the opportunity to flourish in the way that it needs to, particularly with emotional knowledge and emotional capability. So, my word is support those victims. They need it because they need to rehabilitate and undo the damage that really they're the expert on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I tell you I focused on healing my children to such a degree that it really took a lot of my time. I mean, between taking them to various counseling sessions, finding counseling sessions that work for them, counselors that worked for them, because you don't want to talk with everybody, right? Mm-hmm. You may build a relationship with somebody where you don't want to talk to somebody else. And even there, you know, it's a characteristic of an abuser that they will try to destroy the relationships that a child has with a counselor. And so I had setbacks with that too, where, you know, we had to change counselor because my ex basically made my children distrustful of one counselor. And I'd worked for months and months to build. Yeah, I'd worked for months to build their relationship with that counselor. And then the kids are basically saying, no, we're not going there again, because that was the counselor that one of my kids revealed that my ex had been spanking them, right? And so at that point, that counselor was now somebody that the children felt they couldn't trust because mm-hmm. daddy said that was a bad person, right? Because he'd exposed his evil. So, you know, having taking the time to be able to take them to counseling, I mean, all the things that are good for general development of the children, you want to keep that going, but it's such a difficult environment to do that in when somebody else is saying, no, darling, if mummy tells you to do your homework and you don't want to, just don't do it. If the piano teacher tells you to practice in between, just don't do it. Don't want to, right? Mm. you know, manage daily life and, you know, you've got these extras. And so, you know, for my part, you know, I found out about these things because people were going on visits with him and they were hearing him saying these things to the children. So I don't even have to, you know, imagine that this is what was going on. I know this is what was going on because I was told. But, you know, it's a very arduous journey. It's very hard work. And so I will tell you, any person trying to extract themselves from that kind of relationship needs every support that they can get.
Yeah, cool.
They need a team around them. They need prayer warriors. They need a fantastic legal team that actually understands what they're going through. They need people to do yoga with them or whatever relaxes them, right, and takes them out of the moment. They need potentially financial support and all kinds of different support. Yeah. And actually, that's kind of where I'm trying to go with my video games, is to create a community-based game that works globally, that helps people in a domestic violence situation to actually earn money through the game while helping other people that they spot are in a bad situation. So that it's a game that really empowers, not just psychologically, but also financially, for people to be on the right footing to be able to get themselves out of these bad situations so that they can help their kids and themselves, right? Because it's an epidemic, and if we leave it to chance and to the way that it's being addressed right now, we've got a next generation of more chaos.
Yes, absolutely.
And chaos and trauma.
The way the world is, the last thing we need right now is more chaos and trauma. And I'm glad you mentioned the video game again, because like you also mentioned a book. So you've gone through all of that. You've got three children that are in their healing process. And the good thing is that they've been exposed to the truth and they've seen for themselves. So it's not just the case of you're still trying to go against somebody where they haven't seen that side. What's next for Elsa?
Yeah, well, actually, I'd just like to address something you said. So I had to be very careful in the journey not to say negative things about him. And in fact, it was part of my conviction for them to learn for themselves. So I'd just say, you know, anybody that I talk to about this, I try to make it very clear that, yeah, you might want to say all kinds of things about that person.
And,
yes, I have a very strong opinion about that person, but it's not right to express it to the children who already have so much stress going on.
Yeah.
What I found was getting the counselors to help them to understand what is the right way to behave was great. Mm-hmm. And often I would get comments like, well, he said this about you. He said that you're this. He said that you're that. And so I said, well, you know, I try not to say negative things about any other people. How did that make you feel when he said that? I think, you know, I don't really want to participate in saying negative things about people. Mm-hmm. And that's very important for somebody who's going through the court process, by the way, too, because if somebody's accusing you of parental alienation, you really don't want to sit there thinking, oh, I guess I did. Yeah, right. I guess I just so I could sit there in all confidence and know that no, I did not. I did not. But so back to your question, what's next for Elsa? So I'm actually working on a Haitian version of my video game, which I am trying to run a study on in the next few weeks. So all being well in the coronavirus perspective, I've got a version of the video game in Haitian Creole, completely culturally appropriate to domestic violence there, and I'll be running a study as part of my master's degree, my master's thesis, on how that game works and how it helps bystanders, people, to understand what a domestic violence victim may be going through, and you know, helps to teach about resources that are available in that environment, what's realistic, what's not realistic. So that's what I'm doing right now. But my real vision is to obviously to work on the church game as well. And that's kind of a parallel track that I'm working on. And in general for my games, I'm envisioning this community-based game that I was talking about, which requires a completely different technology to what I'm using right now, that would enable, for example, somebody in Malaysia to speak with somebody in London to discover that, oh my goodness, you have laws against emotional abuse in the UK. Wow, we don't have that in Malaysia. Or somebody in Haiti to talk with somebody in the US and find out that, you know, there are resources that they don't have in Haiti that maybe they'd like to group together as a community and figure out how to put together. So so that's my vision for it, something that helps in a holistic way globally.
And when's your book coming out? Aspects.
Well, I got to write it. So I'm probably about 10% done with it. I got a lot of work to do, but I'm very excited. I need to get my Haiti study done and a few other things. And then I'm looking forward to shutting myself in a room with the dog and getting on with it.
That sounds great. Elsa, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. And it has been a journey. And unfortunately, that part of it is not over. But we just do pray your health and strength, that God really does just work it out in your favor, so that you can just put that part of the journey, close that chapter once and for all, and you and your children can just move forward in peace.
Yes, thank you.
In absolute peace, because you deserve it. They deserve it. And as much as many people may not think about it, you know something, your ex-husband deserves some peace, because there's obviously some turmoil or something going on within him that has caused him to be the way he has been. And I just hope and pray that whatever it is that has caused him to become the man he is, that is dealt with and taken care of and really just rooted out.
Yeah. I mean, you have to look at what can create a person to feel that way and to behave that way. And it's very unfortunate, I have to say. You know, you look at experiences from childhood that can cause trauma, that can turn a person to become like this. But at the end of the day, when you are living with somebody like that, you really have to look at damage control. Once you've woken up to what you're dealing with, you have to, and you've got innocent children involved, you really just have to protect. And that's why in my story, I said, I forgave from a distance, recognized that the predator was a predator, and forgave from a distance, because that's the safe thing to do with a predator. Recognize, label, understand. And it, one of the key things that I had ringing through my head through much of what I dealt with was from The Art of War by Sun Tzu. If you know yourself and you know your enemy, you will not fear 1,000 battles.
Wow.
Right? And if you really study and you understand who you're dealing with, then you know where it's safe to be in proximity and where it's not a good idea.
And you know something, you saying that's very key and powerful, you know, because a lot of people in don't know themselves.
Yes.
So that's why a lot of people can quite easily become unhinged when they do meet a predator and cause them to doubt themselves. Because even some of the strongest people that are confident within themselves but don't really know themselves can fall prey and victim to people like your ex-husband and completely be derailed by it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is a very, very powerful quote. Can you say it again for me, please?
Yeah, it's from The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And if you know yourself and you know your enemy, you need not fear 1,000 battles.
Wow, that is so powerful.
Yeah.
Simple, it's yet powerful and profound.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And it was a very helpful thing to keep in my head, because, you know, did I know myself? What did I find out about myself in this journey? I found out that I love the truth and that I really, really have been so blessed with all these angels around me. I can't even tell you, but it really became very valuable to me to make sure that I was maintaining my integrity through the whole process. And I never really considered that so much until I was being tested in this way, where goodness, I mean, there were so many examples where it was tempting to lie or to, well, I really don't need to exaggerate, because the truth is quite technicolor in this instance, but you know, there was just such a peace about knowing that I was telling the truth, that I was maintaining my integrity, all while this tsunami of, you know, or whirlwind more so of lies were around me. I was like, no, this is the truth. I know it to be the truth. I never have to worry about remembering what I said and whether I can repeat it later. I'm good. stick with the truth and be, and you know, I prayed for him. I prayed for him in the early days of it all. I prayed for him a lot more than I do these days, I have to admit. After 5 years, I'm a little tired. tired of exiting. I'm just like, yeah, well, I was just like, get away from me now, please. I don't want any more court cases. But you know, like you said, these people are damaged people wanting to
just
damage
others. Just put that, let me put a disclaimer out there. I'm not saying that to excuse their behavior. So if anybody listens and thinks I'm saying that to excuse any kind of behavior, definitely not. Sorry, Elsa.
Right. No. And you're right to say that. I think, you know, the important thing is to understand, stay away from danger because there's no managing it.
Yeah.
There's no managing that kind of thing.
Wow.
So,
thank you.
But yes, you are welcome. It's been lovely talking with you.
And you.
And I'm glad that I got to tell you about it. And yeah, it's a technicolor story, but I think the important things to remember are support people who say that it's happening to them, because it's such a tiny, tiny percentage of people who make it up. I mean, such a tiny percentage.
Yeah.
I think, you know, somebody who says that they're going through something need full support, because they are the ones who have to try and heal their children.
Yeah. Because in a quote from Frederick Douglass, it's easier to raise healthy children than fix broken men. And that was me paraphrasing. But when you think about that, it's easier to raise healthy children than to fix or repair a broken man.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that really just made me run cold was realizing that my children were being sculpted to be like my ex, to be abusive. He was gaslighting them to think that, you know, it was, the behavior was okay. And imagining, gosh, if one of my sons married somebody and I had a call from my daughter-in-law in the future, like my mother-in-law had from me, saying, help me, I need to stay at your house with the kids tonight. I can't do this anymore. You know, like raising, you got to fix them before they become adults.
Yeah.
You got to give the victims the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your courage.
Thank you
for your spirit. Thank you for being that person that wants to champion the cause for other women and bring about a change, rather than just you've gone through your experience and now you've kind of coming out the other end. And thank you for being selfless in that and just laying yourself bare so that others know that. But it's true, because and one thing I always say, in my coaching, I don't want to come to people from a place of book knowledge. I want to come to people from a place where, like, I can understand where you're coming from, because I've gone through certain things and challenges in my life. And that I find people will more be open to then start to share on a more deeper level, to so that healing can begin and take place. So I
say that
anybody that has the courage to go through what you've gone through and be still looking fabulous on camera.
Thank you.
The end's like, yes, that is my journey. That's what I've been through. I've been fighting literally for my life and the life of my children, but yet you're doing something to bring awareness worldwide. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh. Well, thanks for saying that. For me, it's very important to recognize that some of us don't make it out of this journey. And I have a friend who was shot on her front lawn by her husband during my exit, right? Which makes this all the more special to me to be able to take this platform in her honor, because she can't help her children now. Her parents are... have had to take on that task. And, you know, it's very critical to recognize some people don't make it out mentally from this to be able to do this either. So I consider myself very, very blessed to have been surrounded by all those angels that kept me sane through this, that I am in a position to help my children and to be able to help other individuals and to be able to try to use my technology experience to do something on a more macro level as well with the video game. So I am very lucky, very blessed that you know, I had that support. Not everybody has it.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. Thank you, Elsa.
You're welcome.
Alrighty, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, well, there you have it. A conversation with Elsa Gillingham, talking about her experience with domestic abuse, domestic violence, how she fought through it, and what she did to help make sure that her children were healthy, are healthy, safe, and well. Come back next time for more conversations with Alison J, The Journey to Here.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Alison J, The Journey to Here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit alisonj.net. That's AlisonJaye.net. Alison with one L, as she is the one and only.